Tina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat going hand to hand. Two masters of the trade, conversation hot, you need a fan.
Welcome in, Legal Face Off, WGN Radio, WGNRadio.com. The final episode of April. Rich Lenkoff, Tina Martini, Sam Paniadovich. Holy cow, the band is back together, guys. It's been what, like three episodes?
Yeah, it's been a while.
Most of the band. Bum, bum, bum.
Yeah, last time it was just Rich by himself.
Yeah.
No one wanted to join him.
We lost one band member, but we're happy to have new keyboard player, Ben? Bassist, maybe?
Tambourine player.
Yeah.
Percussion.
Yes, Ben Anderson joining the party as we roll into Legal Face Off. Plenty to get to. A James Comey book is in the works. Rod Blagojevich back in the news. We even have Bill Cosby news. We love talking about Bill Cosby here on LFO. But we start with Professor Melissa Michelson. She's a professor of political science at Menlo College, and she's here to join us to talk about the new book from James Comey. Hello, Professor. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Professor, the big news this week is that James Comey's book, A Higher Loyalty, Truth, Lies, and Leadership, came out, and it's already on the top of the bestseller list. Comey has been doing the speaking circuit also the past few days with George Stephanopoulos and Colbert and appearing on The View, and he'll be talking to Anderson Cooper next week. So, clearly, he's getting a lot of attention and getting a lot of publicity around the book.
The only invite he turned down was Legal Face Off, apparently. He's been on every outlet except for ours, but we're lucky to have the professor.
Yes. So, obviously, a lot to talk about here. Some of the big themes coming out of his book and what he's been talking about on the speaking circuit are the topics of Hillary Clinton and the emails, as well as President Trump and his interactions with him when he was FBI director. So on the Trump front, we all know that Comey's made some pretty strong comments about him, both professionally as well as personally. Among other things, he said his tie is too long, he's orange up close, morally unfit for president. Would you like to comment on some of what Comey's been saying about Trump?
Well, I think the part about him seeming to be orange and his, you know, his tie, that's Comey trying to be a book author in his words. But I think it is something when the former director of the FBI, a top law enforcement official, says that the president is morally unfit. And I think specifically, you know, the reasons he calls Trump out on, that because of Charlottesville, because of treating women like meat, because of how he constantly lies, those are some pretty strong words against the sitting president.
Professor, is there anything, you know, new in the book? I think a lot of people are disappointed. I haven't read the whole thing yet, but I think a lot of people are disappointed with the lack of news. You know, you're always hoping that something really drops in one of these books. Are you surprised by the lack, aside from some of the, you know, personal affectations of the president, lack of anything that's really groundbreaking in this book?
I'm disappointed, but in a way I'm not surprised, because I think Comey has been out there quite a bit trying to explain his decisions and explain his actions. And so it would be disturbing if there was something that he hadn't already told us about his decisions about the email investigation and his decision to release his memo about his private conversation with Trump. So, yeah, as a reader of the book, it's disappointing, but maybe as a citizen, it's a good thing.
So why do you think he's doing this? I mean, obviously, there's money to be made and press to be had and so forth, but why, I mean, aside from those reasons, why do you think he's doing this?
I think that to some extent, Comey feels like he's hurt the FBI, that maybe his decisions have led to some unanticipated negative consequences for the country. And I think in part this is him trying to make things right, that he feels like if he can just explain it one more time in a longer format, that people will understand or agree with him that the decisions he made were the right decisions. So I think in a way he's trying to clear his name and also maybe build back up the reputation of the FBI, which really has been taking quite a hit lately, especially among Republicans.
And it doesn't stop. I mean, you know, Trump continues to go after Comey specifically, you know, calling him a leaker and a liar. He continues to say that the Comey memos show that there was no collusion, no obstruction, that he leaked classified information. Of course, Trump continues to call it the witch hunt. How do you think this affects Trump? You know, it's hard to talk about Trump in the long term because the entire presidency seems to be, you know, not just day by day, but minute by minute. But looking forward to the, you know, congressional, the midterm elections coming up here. How do you think this affects Trump, and how do you think it'll affect, you know, others in Congress? I personally feel like a lot of this, and I think most people feel, you know, many people feel that a lot of this just continues to be red meat for Trump supporters, right? I mean, every time Comey gives an interview, I think his base looks at that as support for what Trump has said and what got him elected.
Yeah, I don't think it's changing anybody's mind. It's more about firing up your supporters, and I think that really speaks to what's going to happen in November. It's really all about turnout at this point. People have chosen their teams. People have chosen their sides, and they're either going to come out or vote or not, but they're probably not going to switch teams, right? Republicans are going to be more likely to follow Trump and to continue to criticize Comey for his decision than they are to suddenly say, oh my gosh, now that I've heard Comey speak, I realize I need to vote Democrat, right? That's not going to happen. And so I think both sides are going to be using this as a way to fire people up and try to get them to the polls in November.
So just getting back to Comey for one second. So obviously when he was FBI director, he was people had mixed opinions on him. The way he left fired some people up. Do you think that with this book and with the speaking tour he's on, do you think that it's making him more likable at this point or less likable, or is the public view of him pretty much the same?
That's a really tough question, and I don't know that I know the answer. I think I came away from the book liking him a little bit more because he really turns into more of a full person. You get to hear about his childhood. You get to hear about his experiences as a younger prosecutor, for example, in his dealings with Martha Stewart. And so I got a fuller picture of who he is as a person, which I think always makes you think of somebody more positively. But, you know, the people who are pissed at him for what he did in 2016 and what he did in 2017, they're probably just going to continue to be pissed at him.
Professor, last question on Legal Face-Off. You teach political science. You've written extensively in this area. Is it good for officials like Comey who write these books? You know, inevitably, in every presidential term, we have members of the administration, cabinet members, others like, you know, heads of the FBI come out and write these tell-alls. Is that good for the body politic? Is it good for the electorate? Does it reveal something about, you know, the inner workings of government? Or is it, you know, does it hurt because it, you know, allows people to enter government maybe with the motive to tell all of their secrets in exchange for a lucrative book deal?
I actually think it's good because I think what these books are rays of sunlight into what's happening in Washington and what's happening in government. And the more books that are written, the more information that the public has about what is happening, the more accountable government is. And so, yeah, to a certain extent, maybe we don't like the idea of all these salacious details being printed and that people are being self-serving. But even if it's self-serving, right, even if Comey and others are writing these books to make money, what it's doing is giving the American public more information about their government, and I think that's always a good thing.
She is Melissa Michelson, professor of political science at Menlo College. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. It was fun.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He's been selected to the 2017 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2017. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEEK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Rich also is the legal analyst for The Bill and Wendy Show and Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez on WGN. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey and Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Moving right along on Legal Face-Off here in Chicago at WGN Radio, David Keating is the president of Institute for Free Speech, IFS.org, and he's joining us to talk about the Supreme Court refusing to hear the Blago appeal. David, welcome to WGN.
Happy to be here.
David, on Monday, as Sam mentioned, the Supreme Court refused to grant certiorari to consider the appeal of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, who is now serving in a jail in Colorado. He's got 6 years left on a 14-year sentence imposed by Judge Zagel. I was on the air yesterday talking about this case and expressing my opinion that I think it was a mistake. I think the Supreme Court, you know, this is exactly in their wheelhouse. They ought to be taking up cases that involve big issues like this, where there is lack of clarity. I think this was exactly that kind of case. Do you agree or disagree? And why do you feel the way you do?
Well, I definitely agree. I mean, the problem is if Governor Blagojevich had been charged in another part of the country, it would have been a different trial with different jury instructions. And I think if you're going to be charged with a federal crime, the standards should be the same everywhere in the United States. Or the problem is there's a very significant split around the country. So the court should resolve it.
Right. So to your point, there are some cases where even more dramatic examples of political horse trading where elected officials have actually received gifts and other compensation have been exonerated, or, you know, case law supports letting those people off and have actually freed some people, whereas Blagojevich, who is convicted of, you know, never convicted of taking anything, just speaking of things, he remains in jail. So could you explain to our listeners a little bit more about why these different cases are out there and how they're treating defendants differently?
Yeah, it is very confusing, really. Basically, you have two Supreme Court decisions that came along in this general area, and different courts have been treating the second decision differently. So in the circuit that covers Illinois, basically, I may be oversimplifying a bit, but not too much. Courts are treating a campaign contribution kind of like a gift to a lawmaker, like even a winter trip to a Florida beach. But in other areas, they make a distinction. Look, a campaign contribution is not the same as a gift, you know, literally putting money in a lawmaker's pockets. And I think most people would say, yeah, that makes a lot of sense because, you know, a campaign contribution just allows an elected official to run a campaign, by and large. Most states prohibit using campaign contributions for personal use. So there's definitely, I think most people would say that's logical. There's a distinction between giving cash or a gift, free hockey tickets, free plane tickets to an elected official, and giving a campaign contribution.
So what are Blagojevich's options at this point now that the Supreme Court decided not to grant cert? What are his options at this stage procedurally?
I don't think he's out of options legally. I mean, the only thing he could hope for is a pardon from the president, which, you know, I don't know about the relationship, but I would be shocked if a pardon was given.
Well, it was interesting because Patty Blagojevich was commenting on this on the news a few days back where, you know, she says that, you know, the president knows him, seems to have a good relationship with him, and seemed to be a bit more optimistic than you seem to be on this front.
Well, I don't have a personal stake in it.
Exactly. Nor do we.
I mean, I might be more optimistic if I had seen the relationship or something, like maybe she has. But I mean, look, even if President Trump wanted to give him a pardon, he's got political calculations to consider. And let's face it, former Governor Blagojevich does not have the best reputation nationally, so I don't see how this could possibly, help President Trump politically by doing something like that. And I mean, really, this enters into people's thinking. Obviously, if you're president, you have to consider the impact on your own campaign.
D- David, you and your organization have been involved in several important cases in which the Supreme Court has been involved. Why do you think the Supreme Court, if we agree that this is the kind of case that they ought to take and that they normally like to adjudicate, why do you think in this particular situation they denied certiorari on two separate occasions?
Well, the first occasion I could understand because not all the facts had come out, and it's possible that when everything was said and done, the Supreme Court would not need to say anything. So, you know, here everything has been, every question, every legal question, every piece of evidence, every fact that could be relevant was now before the Supreme Court. They still said no. You know, the court gets more cases than it can resolve. So, you know, it has to prioritize what it's going to take. I mean, this is just speculation on my part, but, you know, maybe they looked at Governor Blagojevich and just said he has such a horrible reputation, even if this is an important issue, maybe we'll wait for the next person to come along that might be in a similar circumstance, but not quite as so infamous.
David Keating, president at the Institute for Free Speech, IFS.org. David, thanks for the knowledge.
Thank you.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Tina is a partner at DLA Piper and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina is chair of DLA Piper's Intellectual Property Practice Group in Chicago, and she serves as the firm's national hiring partner for associate recruiting. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell, and selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is a columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host. She frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. DLA Piper is a global law firm with lawyers located in more than 40 countries throughout the Americas, Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia Pacific. DLA Piper is positioned to help its clients with their legal needs around the world. To learn more about DLA Piper, please contact Tina or visit DLAPiper.com.
You can follow Legal Face-Off on Twitter. You can like us on Facebook. You can always listen, rate, review the show on iTunes. Search for Legal Face-Off. We continue on. Joining us now, she's a state representative in Illinois from the 12th District. Sarah Feigenholz joining us to talk about the new delay with the DCFS report. Hello, Representative. Welcome.
Thank you. How are you today?
Good. How are you? Thanks so much for joining us. So, Representative, you've been in office now for nearly 24 years, and you've been responsible for spearheading some very important legislation, including stem cell research, education, and affordable health care. And we'd like to talk to you about your press conference earlier this week as it relates to the DCFS and reports that it had withheld information relating to incidents of child abuse over the last few months. And this stems from the fact that it took data that was on its website. It took some data down about incidents of child abuse from its website. And that information remained off of its website until this past Tuesday after you filed a House resolution. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about what happened?
Yeah, this is data that historically has been on the website for the past 35 years. So, of course, it certainly became very noteworthy that suddenly the Department of Children and Family Services removed it. A lot of this data, of course, is very, very important when it comes to tracking trends about what's going on in the state in Illinois.
And so there were claims that they said that that the system through which this information was provided on the website, that had become very out of date and that it was actually the system itself wasn't working. But there were some who believed that they were actually trying to hide the information, particularly because there seems to be an increase, for example, in the number of children being re-abused. Do you want to comment on that?
You know, the website historically had an executive statistical summary, which was pulled off the website last summer. And I begin, you know, I think the committee, Human Services Appropriations, had the director in front of the committee to question her about the budget and general issues, and we were all very concerned about her answer, that she said that the data wasn't useful, that it was about numbers and not outcomes, which, of course, was a new development after 35 years. She also said that it was a computer glitch. So it was very hard to figure out what was going on. It really raised a lot of suspicion. And without the context of her concerns about the computer system, she also said in the broader context that that they're looking whether they're actually legally required to provide the information. So I think that there were a few missteps here, but long story short, once the data was put up there, we saw an increase in the number of children who were re-abused, which has skyrocketed by 50%, and a spike in opioid-related calls, which, of course, rang many, many alarm bells.
Representative, it's very unfortunate that an area that really needs a great deal of transparency and light, like child abuse, has had this degree of secrecy that you've uncovered. Why do you think that is? Is that purposeful? Is it just part of the culture of abuse? What are your feelings on, you know, why this area that really, really does need, you know, the light of day shine on it to be the opposite?
Well, I know, I think that there's a pattern with many agencies in this administration about sharing information and their concerns of transparency. This is a very difficult agency to deal with because it as you can see, you know, this deals with the lives of children that are the state's responsibility. I am an adult adopted person. I'm highly sensitive to the needs of these children. I chaired the Adoption Reform Committee and worked with the James McIntyres of the world, who's now the president of the Illinois Chapter of Foster Care Advocates and really a watchdog of foster kids and what is going on in their lives because of his direct knowledge and personal experience of what it's like to be in the foster care system in this state. I have all the respect in the world for those kids. They are our eyes and ears. And James has been trying to get information out of the department. He has been filing FOIAs. Other child welfare organizations that also have great concern about what is going on in this agency are filing FOIAs, and many of which are not getting responded to. More shrouding and secrecy, which, of course, we are going to continue to push. I was amazed how quickly the information went back up on the website after the resolution was filed, and likely the department got word that we were going to have a press conference, and they responded.
So where do we go from here? I mean, obviously the website's back up. The information is out there. How do we make sure that going forward we have all the transparency that we need, especially for such an important cause like children?
We are discussing and likely to schedule more hearings with the director and her agency to drill even deeper. There is grave concern about the welfare of children that are lacking services. The spike in opioid calls and the number of re-abused children, of course, is definitely cause for alarm here. And we are discussing our approach, whether it be legal or otherwise. Other people are having conversations about what's going on in this, and I'm happy to keep you apprised of what we're going to be doing.
That would be great.
Sarah Feigenholz.
Sarah Feigenholz, State Representative of the 12th District here in Illinois. StateRepSarah.com is the website. We really appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
You can follow Legal Faceoff on Facebook and Twitter. You can also listen to the show per usual on iTunes. And if you like the show, please rate, review, give us a 5-star, and we can move on. Joining us now on the phones, we go back out to the West Coast, and we tag in Donna Rotuno, the law offices of Rotuno and Girolamo. She is the principal attorney and the founder of that firm, and she was in Chicago Magazine, a piece called The Defender. Welcome, Donna, to WGN.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Donna, let's be clear that you're on the West Coast now, but you practice here in Chicago. You're a Wheaton native, and we're in the Me Too movement now. We're in the Me Too era, and you represent many men who are accused of sexual assault. Tell us how you ended up in that particular area of defense.
You know, I think it kind of happened just organically. I was hired to represent men and, you know, in these circumstances, and you get called and you're successful on one and then you're successful on two, and then it sort of becomes something that people call you for. So it wasn't anything that I looked for or sought out, but it's definitely something that has now found me, and I found success in doing it.
So we've covered, you know, this whole Me Too movement, of course, on our show repeatedly over the last year or so. And you're quoted in the Chicago Magazine article as saying that sexual assault is the only crime in our statutes where somebody can be charged with zero evidence to back up the allegation other than someone's word. And, you know, we've wrestled with, I think, as many analysts have, and I think the community in general, with the idea that when it comes to sexual assault, frequently, at least in the court of public opinion, the people who are accused, most generally men, are often convicted without having the benefit of some due process. How do you reconcile those two conflicting, issues? In other words, the desire and need to believe women who have the courage to come forward with these allegations, with the natural need for any defendant to have due process.
Absolutely. I think due process is obviously first and foremost something that we have to look at, and especially in my position, that has to be the number one concern. That being said, I don't believe in any way, shape, or form that there are not true victims out there. There's obviously women who have been put in circumstances where they are victims, and there's no question about it, and I would never say otherwise. But I think the problem is that every single person that comes forward with these allegations is unfortunately not telling the truth. And I think that we need to be able to kind of work through those circumstances and decide where a client falls and on what side of the spectrum they fall on. And I think most often what law enforcement and the state's attorney's office don't sometimes do is look at the motive that someone comes forward with when they make certain allegations. And I think that that sometimes will paint a much broader or more clear picture for those of us on, you know, either side of the coin to be able to say what really the truth is. And so I don't have a hard time reconciling the work that I do, because I think it's important. And I think that when I sit down with people, I can kind of make that distinction about where they fall on the spectrum. But I definitely think that if we, and I think I use the term conviction by allegation, if we allow to convict people merely by allegation and forget the due process side of it, we're doing just an injustice to everybody on every side.
How tough is it to deal with criticism from time to time? I imagine you get a good amount.
You know, I do, but I have to say, I think for the most part, once someone sits down and talks to me and really listens to my perspective on it, I think they understand that I never have felt for one day that my function in the criminal justice system is to send someone home. That's never really been my function. I've always felt that my function should be to hold the system itself accountable. And if the system is not accountable in any of these circumstances, you know, we have a burden of proof for a reason, and that burden of proof is a high standard. It's a high burden for the state, and that has to be met. And I think if people really sit down and talk to me and they believe in our foundation of justice and what this country was built on, I think that it's hard to argue with.
Donna, you talk in the article about the cards being stacked against your clients from the beginning. Do you feel like that's even more true now, given the many allegations that have come out in the public against everyone from, you know, Harvey Weinstein to President Trump and everyone else? Do you feel like, you know, it's even harder now because automatically your clients who are accused of sexual assault are going to be you know, conceived as being guilty in the whole new era that we're living with, even more than they were before?
Without question, I think it's going to be 10 times harder. I think that the scrutiny is going to be greater, and that's okay. I think the scrutiny should be greater. But I think that if you start the scrutiny and you have that scrutiny with sort of a jaded view to begin with, how reasonable is that scrutiny going to be? And so I absolutely think that it's going to be harder. I think it's going to be harder to pick juries. It's hard to pick juries on these cases to begin with because, you know, you never know what bias or what circumstance someone is coming from in their own life. And we can ask a lot of questions, but we'll only get so far. So I think that now in this Me Too movement where, you know, everybody feels like on some level they've been a victim of something, it's going to be much harder for defendants to get fair trials. And I think it's going to be harder for myself and other lawyers in my position to pick juries.
And you've touched on, you know, a really interesting question that we've covered extensively here in the almost 5 years we've been on the air is, you know, with jury selection, you know, the goal always is not to find someone, not to find a juror who knows nothing about a high profile case, because we all know that's impossible, right? I mean, the Cosby trial, correct, that's beginning next week in outside Allegheny County, you know, the questionnaires that came back, and I think all of them knew about the case. The question really ultimately is always whether you can put aside any preconceived notions of guilt or innocence and decide the case on its merits. How do you, as a veteran trial attorney, do that? I mean, there's no magic to it, of course. You know, I try a lot of cases too, but how do you sort of weed through that and get to the jurors that really can give your client a fair shake?
I think really what you have to do is just ask, obviously, a variety of questions, trying to get to the bottom of people's real ability to be fair. I think a lot of it, and you know, I've been asked to teach classes on jury selection, and at the end of the day, a lot of it comes down to my own gut instinct and what I think is the right thing to do. I had a sex case where I left two police officers on my jury, and people thought I was crazy. And I said, I'm leaving these police officers here because they know the penalty, and jurors, as you know, we're not allowed to tell jurors the penalty. And I said, I think people who know the penalty, and I think a lot of times if jurors knew the penalty, things may happen another way, because they may say, well, maybe something happened here, but, you know, this doesn't fit that level of punishment. And so I think what we have to do is just sort of trust our instincts and say, look, I think this person can be fair based on the questions that I asked them or based on their reaction to me, and go from there. It's really not an exact science, unfortunately.
She's Donna Rotuno from the law offices of Rotuno and Girolamo, principal attorney and the founder of that firm, and also the piece, if you missed it, chicagomag.com, in the February 2018 edition. The piece is called The Defender. Donna, thank you so much for your time. Time for the legal grab bag on Legal Face Off,
the way we always wrap it up.
Seven topics today. Donald Trump, the president of the USA, has hired an old buddy, Rudy Giuliani.
Trump and Rudy. Rudy and Trump.
What goes better?
You can't have one without the other. Yeah, Trump. I mean, we sort of saw this coming, that Giuliani would be back somehow. We thought that he would be hired as the attorney general. Maybe he will be when Sessions is fired. But yesterday, Trump announced that Rudy is joining his legal team. Couple interesting tidbits are that Trump, or I should say Rudy and Comey, have been fighting for years. Going back to, in Comey's book, he talks about going back years when Rudy was a U.S. attorney. He is a federal prosecutor in New York running the Manhattan U.S. Attorney's Office. Guess who also worked there? James Comey. Comey in his book talks about how Giuliani is a showman, has an insatiable desire for public attention and acclaim. He said that when he was U.S. attorney in Manhattan, he left a trail of resentment among the dozens of federal judges in Manhattan. It's also interesting that Giuliani told the Washington Post yesterday that he's doing this, meaning he's joining the Trump team, to negotiate an end to this for the good of the country, because he has high regard for the president and for Mueller. When you think about that, negotiate what? This is a, you know, special prosecutor that's been appointed by the deputy attorney general, this is not some real estate deal that you can negotiate an end to. There's no negotiating an end
to... Come on, Rich. Give it up on the...
It's pretty amazing.
On that boilerplate.
Well, that he would say that he's trying to negotiate an end. I mean, the end, you know, might be Trump impeached. It's not some deal where you can negotiate the end of it. Mueller's not going to be influenced by, you know, Giuliani coming aboard. So it'll be fun, but look forward to seeing what Giuliani does.
Have you read Comey's book yet?
I have not.
Are you going to?
I'm still trying to get through Fire and Fury. I'm still on that one.
CNN is reporting no criminal charges in the death of Prince. What do we know here?
Yeah, Prince, it was announced yesterday that the investigation ended with no charge. No one will be charged in the death of Prince. This was per the Carver County attorney. Yesterday, they were investigating the cause of death, which we've now learned was an opiate overdose. It was fentanyl. There was also some counterfeit Vicodin that were laced with fentanyl. But the attorney said that Prince had no idea he was taking a counterfeit pill that could kill him. There's no evidence showing how Prince obtained the pills, no evidence as to their source. Because of that, there's no criminal. There will be no criminal charges filed in the case. This is almost 2 years after Prince was found unresponsive in an elevator at Paisley Park in Minnesota. He was 57 at the time. Fentanyl, as we all know, is an incredibly powerful opiate. It's 30 to 50 times stronger than heroin. But the attorney in Minnesota has ruled that was, while tragic, it was an accident. There was no criminal. There will be no criminal charges.
But it looks like his
Wait
position.
A minute.
Go ahead.
How do we all know what fentanyl? How do we all know what fentanyl is? Speak for yourself.
Right. Yeah, I've got this cousin who told me about it. Friend of mine.
And we all know what fentanyl is. I'm like, wait a minute, what?
Well, and I have parents who are pharmacists, so, you know, I guess the drug knowledge just is, you know, it's been passed down to me over the years.
But I'm actually a little surprised that they're not going after the doctor, because his doctor prescribed...
Well, they did. I mean, he's paying $30,000.
Right, but I mean, no criminal charges.
No criminal charges.
He prescribed Percocet... in the name of Prince's former drummer.
To try to keep it anonymous. But that is violating the Controlled Substances Act.
Right, exactly. So they came up with a settlement. But, you know, I don't know. If I was the attorney, I would have gone after him criminally just to send an example that maybe you should not be prescribing these lethal drugs to people under assumed names.
Fair enough. Favorite Prince song, by the way? Purple Rain for me.
Little Red Corvette all the way.
Yeah, I'm a Nothing Compares to You fan. Kiss, of course. I also love Raspberry Beret. You know, the kind you find
too.
In a secondhand store?
Secondhand stores. We all shop there. All right, moving on. We've been on Legal Face-Off here for 4 years, and for 4 years we've talked about Bill Cosby. And
Cosby
Bill Cosby
Watch.
Is back in the news.
Cosby Watch continues. The prosecution has rested. The trial can go to a jury as early as next week. The defense, again, has tried to get a mistrial. They failed at that attempt. Lots of good stories coming out of the trial this week. Margo Jackson claimed earlier this week on Wednesday that Cosby's accuser, Andrea Constan, is lying about the assault, trying to frame Bill Cosby for money. It's been revealed, of course, that Constant received a $3.4 million settlement from Cosby. That was a major issue at the beginning of the trial this week. Cosby's lawyers this last couple days argued that the prosecution misled the jury by suggesting that the defense team somehow helped to craft the accusations of this witness, Jackson. That was the basis of their request for a pretrial. The Judge O'Neill denied the motion, said there were simply no grounds for a mistrial at this time, which means the next round of witnesses are proceeding. And again, the jury can get this case as early as next week. What do you think? We think he's going to be guilty or mistrial again? Or what do you think, Sam?
I don't know. I wish he'd just go away.
Yeah. Gina?
Wish he'd just go away.
I agree with Sam.
Go away, Cosby.
Go away.
All right.
Go away. Animal Park. An animal park in Iowa must remove a couple of animals because of an Endangered Species Act violation.
Yes, we must always make sure that we think of the animals here on Legal Face-Off. So a former zoo in Iowa has to transfer all of its lemurs and tigers to other zoos now because it has been found to violate the Endangered Species Act. The Eighth Circuit upheld a magistrate judge's decision to transfer the animals that were at what is known formerly as the Cricket Hollow Zoo in Manchester. And these animals are now being transferred to Wisconsin and Indiana because they were inadequately cared for. Lemurs are social animals, in case you guys don't know that.
Don't have to tell me that.
Do you have
Sam
one?
Sam knows that for sure. Sam had a relationship with a lemur for a short period of time. I think it was, what, 2016?
You did. It was a tough break.
Did you get a lemur back then?
They're so
I do not
cute.
Want to talk about it.
They're so cute and cuddly. Are you pleading the fifth, Sam?
Bestiality, statute of limitations.
I did not say that.
It's run, Sam.
I did not say those words.
Don't worry. You're safe.
But anyway, lemurs are social animals. And unfortunately, they were not kept in a condition conducive to their development. And the tigers were mistreated as well. They were not given clean water or sanitary conditions. So one of the plaintiffs to the suit is the Animal Defense Fund. And the executive director said that the decision affirms that endangered animals enjoy the same protections regardless of whether they are in captivity or in the wild. And so the zoo has since had its license revoked, and it is now known as the Cricket Hollow Animal Park. The court refused the plaintiff's request to absolutely close down the zoo. An interesting statistic I want to share with you guys and get your thoughts. So according to a recent Gallup poll, over 30% of Americans believe that animals should have the same rights and protections as people. What do you guys think about that?
Well, I mean, yes, but to an extent, right? I mean, we wouldn't have many advances in science we have if we weren't, if not for testing animals, right? I mean, a lot of that inherently has to be done with, rats and other animals. So, yes, but you don't want to, would you sacrifice advances in medical care to save a rat, for example?
I don't think so. Not if we could, advance
cure
science.
Cure cancer.
No. But so, I wouldn't want that being done to my dog or my cat.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, I think this is a pretty groundbreaking decision in favor of animal rights, especially when it came to the language. You mentioned some of it, but the court also said that it recognized the unique biological and psychological needs of these animals, which is pretty,
it's
unique
remarkable.
Language to use. So, it just underlines the point that here on Legal Face-Off, we'll cover everything. I mean, if it's legal, we'll find it. We'll find Endangered Species Act violations. We'll talk about Cosby.
We should bring the animals in as guests in studio sometime.
Yeah. Sam, could you get in touch with your former lemur?
I plead the fifth.
Let me get my sound effect apps. Hang on. Keep going.
I have a lawsuit brewing. You look that up.
Hey, I like that. I like that pun. Lawsuit brewing.
So Sony is suing a company, actually a brewer, that is trying to capitalize on the TV show Breaking Bad. Maybe you've heard of it. The beer was called Breaking Bud, and to Sony, that's an issue.
Yes. Wow, that's very ferocious sounding. I'm scared.
That's exactly
now.
What she sounded like. How did you find
Whoa.
Her?
Oh. Your former apartment's been tapped. So anyway, so this past Tuesday, Sony sued Knee Deep Brewing for trademark infringement, dilution, false designation of origin, and unfair competition. They're also seeking an injunction against the brewing company. All of this arose, as Sam mentioned, out of Knee Deep's use of the name Breaking Bud in connection with its craft beer, which pays homage to the famous show Breaking Bad. Sony claims that the brewery is trying to capitalize on the fame of the hit series, which has been cited as one of the greatest television series in history. I've never watched it, but...
What?
I know. It's got it.
It was a show that introduced everyone to binge watching, pretty much.
Wow. I guess I'm late to the party. So Sony's attorneys...
Stop with all that highbrow TV watching that goes over... over at the Sistine compound.
At the Sistine compound.
It's all like BBC and foreign
not.
Documentaries over there.
We actually rewatch series like The Sopranos, and we're about to queue up Seinfeld again.
Wow. You just can't find anything now to watch. You
got
to go back 30
years. Well, no, we're
actually
saying goodbye to Scandal, so don't tell me what happened on Scandal. I know the last show was last night. We've DVR'd it. So we watch some contemporary stuff,
any
too.
Billions, any Billions watchers out there?
No.
Tina? Sam? Billions?
I've not seen it. I've heard good things.
All right, back to our story.
Yes. So what's interesting about this is that the CEO of Knee Deep Brewing said that he was very surprised by the fact that Sony filed suit because apparently he claimed several years earlier that the brewery was talking to Sony about how much Sony appreciated the fact that the brewing company was paying homage to Breaking Bad. And he ended his statement by saying that they're a very small brewery and that the litigation has been unfortunate, particularly since they thought that Sony was appreciative of the fact that the brand was really developed to pay homage to the show. So it'll be interesting to see if this goes along the lines of a parody defense, which we've seen in a number of trademark cases over the years. You guys may remember when North Face went after South Butt. Do you remember that case?
I do not remember that. Did you represent any of the parties?
No, not that I recall. Not in that litigation, no. But there was a kid, I think he was out of Michigan, University of Michigan, who started an apparel company out of his dorm room called South Butt. And it was really meant to parody North Face. But North Face sent a cease and desist letter, which the student then proceeded to put online. And so the case ultimately settled, but it was an interesting case in the history and trajectory of cases regarding parody, which I happen to know quite a bit about. They're actually very interesting cases.
Yeah, I mean, you're an IP expert. How much does the defense that this was a tribute, I mean, does that hold any weight legally?
Well, it depends on the facts and circumstances. I mean, parody is a very fact-specific sort of situation. I mean, the fact is what they're claiming is that there was some sort of acquiescence here, that they were talking 3 years ago, and that Sony, at least as far as the CEO of the brewing company goes, his belief was that Sony had agreed that it was a good thing and they acquiesced to it. So we'll have to see.
Lawsuit. More lawsuits. We have CBS against Desilu Studios. I Love Lucy.
Yes. So I don't know if you guys ever watched I Love Lucy. I grew up watching it.
Not to be confused with the Isle of Lucy referenced in Spinal Tap.
Oh,
remember,
yes.
The Isle of Lucy,
Musical Fest? Yes.
Spinal Tap reference, Sam, way before your time.
A little bit.
So Desilu Studios is actually a new technology-focused film and television studio, and they filed suit against CBS last week over rights to use the term Desilu in connection with some TV shows that CBS has rights into that once belonged to Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz's production company, which they called Desilu Productions, and was responsible for shows such as I Love Lucy, Star Trek, and Mission Impossible. The new iteration of Desilu Studios, was formed in 2013, and the owner of Desilu Studios actually went and got a federal trademark registration, which issued in January. It was around that time that the owner of Desilu Studios reached out to the daughter of Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, and her name is Lucy Arnaz, which a lot of listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with her. And they were reaching out to her about resurrecting Desilu. CBS found out about it and asked Lucy Arnaz not to further communicate with Desilu Studios. And what's interesting is that this whole situation arises out of the fact that Desilu Productions, which is the Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz company, those rights were transferred about 15 years ago when CBS and Viacom split up, and there were certain rights that CBS retained, certain rights that Viacom retained, and now they're talking about bringing the companies together again, and now there's a question about what CBS owns. So while some are claiming that CBS owns rights to the actual shows, they don't actually own rights to use the term Desilu. So it's going to be interesting to see how this one plays out.
Wasn't a huge Lucy fan.
Oh, I loved Lucy. Oh my
really?
God. And then Desi Arnaz Jr., Brady Bunch, Marsha meets Desi Arnaz Jr.
Yeah.
She'll never wash that cheek again. Or was that the monkey? Remember? God, what was his name? Davy Jones? Yeah, I think it was.
That was Davy Jones, yeah.
Are you sure? Because I thought it was Desi Arnaz Jr.
No. I think Desi Arnaz Jr. would have been too old for her, no? Not that Davy Jones
no
wasn't.
No one is ever too young for Desi Arnaz Jr.
Yeah. Sam, any I Love Lucy Any? Are you a fan of that show? I think not. Sam, are you there? Sam is gone. Sam has abandoned us on the island where she's staying.
I loved Desi Arnaz Sr. too. He was really cute.
Yeah.
He's Cuban. I mean, come
fairly
on.
Fairly groundbreaking relationship, though, in TV history.
You absolutely. Know, inter, I mean, she had, and then she had her kids while they were, she yeah. had Desi Arnaz Jr.
And they called it, what do they call it? They couldn't say she was pregnant. She was, there was another euphemism they used back then with Lucille Ball.
With child? I don't know.
It was something like that. Because they couldn't say
well,
she was pregnant.
Well, they were very careful how they filmed her, too.
Yeah.
It was a great show.
Last topic, Lance Armstrong and a settlement with the U.S. government.
Yeah, this is a long-standing lawsuit finally settled yesterday. Lance will pay the U.S. government $5 million for using PEDs while he was being paid $31 million in sponsorship fees. So between 2001 and 2004, the Postal Service paid him $31 million. Him and his team, all the while he was denying using performance-enhancing drugs. So the government sued him back in 2013 for breach of contract for using prohibited drugs. It was just after he was interviewed by Oprah and admitted to using PEDs. And they said, you know, you shouldn't, on the one hand, be taking our sponsorship fees, on the other hand, cheating. And also joining in this settlement will be Floyd Landis, who was Armstrong's former teammate, who filed a whistleblower suit and will take part in the money recovered by the government. He's expected to receive about $1 million. So maybe it does pay to cheat if you're Floyd Landis. Sam?
Lance Armstrong is such a dip. I can't stand him. I mean, he's such a fraud. I remember
He's a podcast competitor. He's got his own pod. Do you ever listen to his?
No, and I never will. How many people, and then he ripped everybody off with the Live Strong stuff, too. Remember that? How much money he made off that while he was cheating?
Well, guess what? I could go back to never talking about or watching bicycle racing again after this minute that we talked about racing. Do you ever watch the Tour de France in your... You watch everything as a sportscaster.
I watched it because when he was dominating, I was in high school, but I didn't really watch it that attentively. Tina, I don't know if you're a big cycling fan either, but... I mean, there's really no reason to watch it. It's just boring to me. I don't know.
Well, you just watch someone on a bike, you know, like the scenic, you know, the scenery changes. But I loved to bike, and I biked a lot when I was young, but I never really watched cycling very much.
WGN never sent you to France to cover it, huh?
No, never did. And don't get me started on cyclists in Chicago, because they don't look or watch out for anybody. They're on a mission. They'll run you over if you're not paying attention.
Are they nicer in Vegas?
No,
they're just drunker.
It's just too hot to cycle outside.
Cyclists everywhere, beware. Rich Lankoff, Tina Martini, my name is Sam Panionovich. Thanks to Ben Anderson, thanks to all of our guests, and we will talk to you in May on LFO. Take care.